Hello, and welcome to The Rest is Education. In this episode, we're going to talk about what makes an excellent senior school curriculum. I'm Isabel Rich, and I'm here with fellow co-host Ross Borthwick, who happily happens to know rather a lot about curriculum, in fact, and our guest, Neil Birch. Neil has been teaching for over 20 years, having both worked in the state and independent sector here in the UK and overseas. Right now, he's senior master at an independent senior school called Bradfield College and was previously deputy head academic. His role has enabled him to be involved with, amongst other things, curriculum design. Rather convenient for this conversation. He's also been a governor at the Willink, which is a comprehensive school in Berkshire, and at an international school in France. Welcome, Neil.
Hello, thanks for having me.
And welcome, Ross.
Hello, lovely to be back and glad to see you in the chair.
Very exciting. I am very excited too. So this is part two of our series on school curriculum. Last week, David Marshall, our co-host, discussed primary curriculum. It was an excellent pod. I really enjoyed listening to it. It was pretty high level stuff, and it deep dived into what makes a good primary curriculum. There was lots of debate about knowledge gathering versus skills building and how to balance depth versus breadth in the curriculum. There was also an agreement that it's vital to think about the fact that primary curriculum does really need to prepare students for their transition to secondary school. So that'll be interesting to think about that perhaps later on in the podcast today. There was no doubt this is a thorny issue in terms of trying to think what makes for a successful curriculum when designing it. It's not an easy job. There's just so much that you want to include, but there's also a finite amount of time when you want to actually teach it all. We're going to actually cover some of the same questions that they did last week, because they're the sort of questions that I really feel come to life when you hear all sorts of different responses to them. And we're obviously also going to look more closely about what works best in the senior school setting. So let's start off with a question that we chatted about last week. And it's, what do we actually mean by the word curriculum? What does it encompass? Neil, what's your thoughts on that?
Thanks, Isabel. Yeah, I actually listened to the first half an hour of the primary school curriculum discussion that you had prior to this. And it was really interesting. And it is a really, really hard question. What is the curriculum? I mean, it's really simplistic. One way of describing it could be it's what you teach. But I think the really interesting piece is how you teach it. But equally, you could look at it in a broader sense and say that a curriculum is the pupil's experience from the moment they come into school and the moment they leave school, everything about it. So curriculum can be broken down into material that they have to learn, concepts that they have to grapple with, but equally it's the whole values and behaviours of the immediate atmosphere that is influencing them as well. That's still part of learning. And of course, the curriculum can, and to my mind, should be considered in the broader sense beyond the academic curriculum. So you could consider it as pupils' in whole day experience, or you could break it down into what we teach them. And that's a really interesting discussion, particularly in the current age. But the really interesting piece, the piece that requires really skilled teachers, is how we teach that.
Yeah, I agree. That'll be something we can really chat about later. And I absolutely adore the way that you're involving the entire of the school day. It makes it rather a gargantuan task and thought, but I guess that's really important. It's not just about when they're sitting in a classroom learning. It's everything else that goes around it to make them the humans that they are when they leave school. Ross, any thoughts from you on what makes a curriculum in your eyes?
You couldn't agree more really with Neil. I think the whole day, you know, starting and roll call, talking about the expectations and really building that sort of cultural capital from the moment they come in the door. We have chapel here every day, sometimes twice a day. And so, you know, that I would say is part of the curriculum here, spiritually and also in terms of morals and again, that sort of cultural input. Just building on the episode we had on outdoor learning, you know, all of that, I think I would also include. And just one hot off the press, address quite a humorous email from a parent today asking the rationale behind the reels that we were teaching at Kaylee practice. So I would even include dancing.
Oh, fantastic. And I guess, Neil, you've sort of covered it a little bit in your answer, but I suppose, what do you think, and you had such great experience of this, because we're going to come on to talk about in more detail later about what you've done at your school, the aims of a curriculum, what is it in a senior school setting that we're trying to do with this curriculum, would you say?
I think it sounds pretty naff, doesn't it? But we're preparing them for when they leave school. So when we take the reins off, they have all the characteristics and attributes that we think they need to make a positive contribution to society, that they understand what their values are and then they enact them, that they can stand on their own two feet, they're resilient, they're open-minded, they're empathetic, they are brave enough to give things a go. I think, crucially, they understand what failure is. And that in the adult world, you will fail many, 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 many times. And that's perfectly normal. But having the ability to kind of unpick those failures, evaluate and find an alternative path through, that's what we're preparing them for. But in terms of more tangible outputs, you know, there's no doubt in senior school, we need to get the passport stamped. And that passport might be good grades and a really strong UCAS reference. Or Common App if they're going to the States, North America, or mainland Europe. So they need those qualifications. They need some work experience. They need to have good physical and mental health, so they'd be fully engaged in the co-curriculum, not just sport. It might be performing arts. So I think it's a multiple things. I think there's a mix of kind of the essence of what makes us human, and that's something you mentioned earlier. I think that's critically important, and I'm sure, if not in this podcast, another podcast, we'll get into the role of AI and how it's really going to exacerbate and shine a light on that. But more tangible things, you know, it is about grades. I have got quite a strong view that those grades are now out of, you know, those examinations are completely outmoded. And there's a divergence between what were the grades and how they're achieved and actually what the world needs. But they do need some grades to go into sixth form. Then they need either A-levels or IB points to make a really strong university application. Other credentials alongside that, but also the whole character and behaviours piece as well.
Yeah, I agree. And that's, I go around quite a few secondary schools. And it doesn't matter what setting I'm in, whether it's a specialist school teaching children with specialist educational needs, it's a state comprehensive, or it's an independent fee-paying school. The thing that is the catch-all phrase is preparing students for adulthood. Now, that means something different to different students in different settings. But ultimately, for me, in a secondary setting, that is what you're doing. That may lean more heavily on qualifications, as you mentioned, IB, A-levels or what have you. But equally, it could be more vocational skills for other students who perhaps don't want to follow that pathway. And actually, another thing on that is that word pathway, which again, you mentioned the word a bit sort of naff and cliched, but a lot of people I meet in the secondary sector talk about the right pathway for that student. And school seems to be the most incredible hub to help and support students to find that pathway that's going to suit them when they leave school. Ross, any other thoughts from you?
Just the, you know, the word pathway. And I was sort of thinking about my own education. There was just this assumption that there was a linear sort of pathway into work. And I think the Labour government at the time wanted half of all school pupils to go on to be university graduates. And it didn't really matter what they graduated in. And I think, you know, today's world is very, very, very different to that. And, you know, what can we do in school to prepare pupils for that reality? I think probably provide them with the broadest possible range of experiences. And, yeah, you know, those skills that, you know, we talked, I hate to call them soft skills, but Neil mentioned, you know, resilience and the ability to fail and learn from mistakes. I think, you know, that's absolutely crucial.
Yeah. And I feel having been around schools, as I said, who've got students of all abilities and from all walks of life, it's also about championing and heroing the less traditional pathway out of school. and just finding the thing that suits them. I'd love to now actually chat to you, Neil, and hear about what's been going on at Bradfield College, because that's the reason we've got you on this podcast. You are somebody who has been heavily involved in designing a really specialised and personal curriculum for the school. And it'd be fascinating to find out a little bit about what that entails and why you came to those conclusions when you were obviously developing the concept. So over to you, Neil. We want to hear more, please.
So here at Bradfield, our mantra is, and it's not particular, it's not unique in any way, shape or form, but we say we are offering an education for life, which is really, really, really broad. But, you know, from a marketing sense, you know, people are going to know what we're trying to achieve. And therefore, that puts us on the hook, an education for life, to make sure that it is always relevant and it's contemporary and it is going to do what it says on the tin. You know, what are pupils going to need to be? What are they going to have for 2030 and beyond? And so over the course of 2 years, actually, we did a huge amount of research. We listened to our parents. We spoke to universities. We spoke to employers and said, what is it that you need? And the common theme that was coming through was this idea that qualifications alone just aren't the currency that they once were. Mm-hmm. At one end of the spectrum, that's putting it mildly, some organisations saying we are now qualifications blind. We've got no interest in that at all. Year on year, the coin has been debased and now everything's been homogenised. And so actually, we just can't differentiate the type of candidate that we want in our university or our place of work. So this idea of, I suppose, the human qualities came through, and you can include that skills, things that they can actually do, a mindset that pupils have. And I like to think at Bradfield, we've always done it, pretty well. We've always offered it, but largely by serendipity, albeit it's pretty broad across the curriculum. But we actually thought, no, we need to make a commitment and do this a little bit more intentionally. And so after, you know, continued research and discussion, we looked at, well, what are these skills? Now, if you go back to kind of the Govian discussion of goodness knows when, there was this kind of fatuous discussion, is it knowledge and facts or is it skills? And of course, you've got to have both. Like you have to know, yes. You have to know information in order to apply it, to share it, to solve complex problems, to think critically, etc. You have to have a knowledge base. So that was silly right from the off. So when I say that we're now intentionally introducing and inculcating a set of skills, that is absolutely not at the expense of what could be seen as traditional knowledge and equally, you know, real stretch and challenge. Anyway, long story short, after lots of discussion with, reading and research with organisations such as World Economic Forum, OECD, what came through was ideas around complex problem solving, critical thinking, self-regulation, presentation skills, and digital literacy. And they are the five skills which in year nine, which is the first year here in the college, we are now explicitly teaching and assessing in a way that we haven't before. And by that, we've borne skills rubrics, various assessments. There are still the old traditional block tests, end of topic tests, timed essays, etc. But now there are assessments, as I say, targeting any of those five skills. So that's what's happening in year nine. In parallel with that, we have also started to step away from GCSEs. We work closely with something called the School Directed Course Consortium, which has got 80 or so affiliated schools. And we are now designing our own proprietary level two equivalents, which give us the scope to keep things really contemporary in what we teach, but also the means. So online portfolios, conscious, intentional use of AI, et cetera, in a way that we can actually pick up some of these skills from year nine and carry them right the way through to year 11.
That's fascinating, because actually when I was watching and listening all about the curriculum that you've employed with your brilliant video, it was one of my key questions, was like, golly, they're doing this incredible curriculum in year nine, which is really celebrating these modern skills like critical thinking and presentation. And I was like, hold on a second. Then they go into year 10 and it's the GCSE 2-year marathon sprint, whatever you want to call it. It's mega to get all that knowledge in to be able to complete the exam. So that's answered my question, is actually you're in a position where you're able just to go, actually, that's not going to work. It's too jarring. We're going to move away.
Yeah, and I presume that's why you did it. There is going to be a slight jarring because we are moving away from GCSEs in a strategic way. We're looking at certain subjects. That is certainly part of the frustration in year nine science, but they're doing some really interesting extended projects by way of developing their introduction and development of how they think and try to solve real world complex problems, where we've created the time and space. But then you tick over into year 10 and, for example, you're staring at this huge flabby GCSE biology course, which you've just got to get through so quickly because it contains so much content. And there just isn't the time to revisit the skills which we know are so important and which were introduced in year nine. But there are some subjects. So we started with, we call them our SDC courses, school directed courses. So we have SDC music. Next year, we won't be teaching Greek. We'll be teaching SDC Greek civilization. And then we have a number of other subjects coming out the block for 2026.
Neil, can I just ask quickly, how, obviously your exit point is 18. So you don't need to necessarily worry about not having accredited qualifications at 16 as such, but, during the consultation process for this, were there any reservations from parents about moving away from GCSEs?
I mean, you're absolutely right. So 95% plus of our pupils will go into our sixth. And the reality is, because we're doing it incrementally, most Bradfieldians will have 8 or 9 GCSEs and one of our SDC courses. So still more than enough GCSEs, and then they will all go on and do A-level or IB. In terms of the, I think a lot of curriculum change is it's a communication project. And actually, I think to make it a success, you need to give as much time to the comms around this as you actually do the design of the course. Because the design is the easy bit, because you tend to have like-minded people around the table all nodding, really excited, because the inner educationist comes through and we know it's right. But then you've got to communicate that to the staff, to governors, to parents and pupils, etc. We held a town hall for SDC music. So we had confirmed that we were no longer teaching GCSE music. On a dark Sunday evening, and we had 6 sets of parents turn up. And I thought, oh my goodness, this is going to die on its feet. This is terrible. We have a 3-year rolling average of 25 pupils doing music. And I thought this is as bad as it could be. And yet, SART signed up, we had 21 pupils. So, you know, broadly in line with the 3-year rolling average, which told me that, or I believe, that we had communicated it reasonably well. And for lots of parents, it either wasn't a big deal because they were going to have 8 or 9 GCSEs, or I'd really like to think they were super excited about a course which improved the musicianship of pupils, which focused on a set of skills, which introduced a broader range of assessments so more pupils could demonstrate their skill rather than just a composition and a terminal assessment, and genuinely represented better preparation for the sixth form. So I hope it was the latter. I hope they read it and went, wow, this is fantastic. We should just be doing this.
Yeah, it wasn't. It was just a bit cold on that Sunday evening.
Yes, yeah, exactly. I think the snacks weren't great.
Yeah, I think they trusted you. Actually, before we chat to Ross about what's been going up north of the border, what I'd also like to touch on, if I may, is an interesting conundrum which can occur, is the difference between A-levels and IB curriculum, actually, which is obviously something that you offer. You've got the luxury, obviously, of having enough teachers and timetabling to be able to facilitate that. Maybe just for those who are listening, you could just give a brief overview about the differences between A-level and an IB curriculum in the sixth form.
So when I when I was deputy head academic, I had to be Switzerland. I had to be very neutral. Now that I'm no longer deputy head academic, I can be partial and say that I think that...
Oh, yes.
The personally, I think the IB is far superior. I think it is more contemporary. It looks through an international lens. It gives pupils more agency. It allows them to fail in a way that's so, so important. I don't mean fail at the end, but I mean fail in the process, but then gives them, genuinely gives them time to actually revisit, review and improve. And I think it's accessible to every single pupil. It's not, you know, I think historically it's deemed as, oh, because you're doing six subjects rather than three, therefore it's only for the super bright, the very academic. And that absolutely isn't true. I actually think some pupils that find the classroom a real challenge far better off doing the IB because they have more structured teaching time. They are taught face-to-face more often than they are the A-level, where they'll have more independent study periods, for example. I don't think any one pupil should do the A-level or the IB. It's just down to personal preference. There are some subjects that we offer on the A-level, but not on the IB, and vice versa. It's very easy to say the IB gives you an advantage when getting into the States, because when you apply to the US, you have your major, your minor, then you have your third section, which is general education, which is broad, similar to the IB, which you may have experienced. But the reality is, if you've got three A-levels and a good ACT or SAT score, you'll get into to North American universities anyway. So it just comes down to personal preference. But I don't think there is a type of pupil that should do A-level or a type of pupil that should do the IB. And the only exception there is mathematicians that want to go into a certain type of engineering because there isn't, within the further maths on the IB side, there isn't mechanics. Mechanics is really important for engineering. Now, it isn't to say that IB-only schools here in the UK don't send lots of kids off to great engineering schools, but parents should just be aware of that.
I suppose as well, Neil, one advantage of the IB is CAS. So this idea of creativity, activity and service. And that's pretty integrated as well.
Yeah, and our schools have always done that, but certainly within the IB, you get some recognition for it. Here at Bradfield, our pupils do three A-levels or four if they do further maths and an EPQ. On the IB side, there is the extended essay within that. So an extended piece of research, which requires a presentation, is present on both curricula. But I think having worked for 13 years on this, I genuinely don't think a pupil should sit in the fifth form around about now in January and February and have the mindset, I am an A-level pupil or I am an IB pupil. They should actually reverse engineer for them. I've got this career in mind. I have these strengths and weaknesses in the way that I work. I enjoy these subjects. Choose that first, then come to the decision as to whether they go A-level or IB.
That's fascinating. Thanks, Neil. Now, Ross, north of the border, up in Scotland, you have been, I believe, working with the curriculum team at your independent senior school there. Perhaps you could fill us in with what's going on with you.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're at a bit of a crossroads, really, in terms of our curriculum, and we are currently working on reviewing that curriculum. There are a number of factors, really, but just to give you some background, so quite an old school, founded by Gladstone, and has pretty much been wedded to A-levels, which is quite unusual here in Scotland, where the educational landscape is sort of Nat 5s followed by highers. And generally, pupils go to university aged 17 if they're staying in Scotland. They can obviously go down to England, but they might require more UCAS points to do that. And they may well, if they were going to do that, stay on and do advanced hires. So that's sort of the landscape. But we, as I say, have traditionally taught an English curriculum of GCSEs and A-levels. Now, a few years ago, a parent approached the school and loved the school, had gone through the school themselves, but did ask whether there was the opportunity for their son to do a vocational course, which we didn't offer at the time, in the form of a BTEC in countryside management. This particular boy wanted to study A-levels and then go on to agricultural college, as some of them do. I suppose the question was asked. There was no real reason to say no. We're very fortunate in that we're on a 340-acre estate and there are plenty of countryside management tasks that need to be done. So, it was fairly easy, I think, for us to implement that at the time. And the course has just grown and grown. And it's now one of the most popular courses alongside A-levels at Lower Sixth. And, so that was a change. You may or may not be aware, but the government are withdrawing funding for BTECs. So in 2 years' time, that particular BTEC and almost all of them won't exist. And so we're now looking at what to replace that particular vocational course with, if anything. So there's that conversation happening. And then you may have seen in the news about a year ago, there was some talk of a school nearby closing, quite a well-known independent all-girls school, boarding school, very close to us. And it did, in fact, close. And so at the beginning of this academic year, lots and lots of those girls came to us. Obviously, you know, that couldn't have been planned for, really, and we just had to adapt as best we could. But the facts are that that school delivered hires and not A-levels. And so lots of those girls had started their higher journey. And so we then had a moral obligation to finish that journey for them. So we're now in a situation where we're teaching GCSEs lower down, A-levels, hires, and BTEC. And so, you know, that requires a lot of administration, lots of exam boards. Obviously, there are multiple exam boards within each component as well. Lots of different exam dates, coursework dates, all sorts of things, constantly moving. And so the curriculum review committee, of which I'm a part, is looking at sort of the future, I suppose, and really what the considerations should be. So we've been influenced by market forces. And it's just interesting to see what we're looking at going forward. And obviously I can't say too much because, you know, you never know who might be listening, but yeah, there's a lot of excited talk at the moment. You know, I can certainly talk about sort of potential ideas. So, you know, you're talking about IB. I think our main competitor up here, they're an IB all through school and they also offer boarding. And so I'd imagine if you wanted that form of education, you would just go there. You know, there are certain options which, you know, may be worth pursuing, but I'm not convinced for us that would be one of them, even though I completely agree with everything Neil said. And I think it offers a fantastic modern and service-based curriculum, which is valued by universities. So I think, yeah, there are lots of interesting discussions going on here and, yeah, a lot of market research being done. But do I think A-levels are going to disappear? No, I really don't. I think they still offer something quite special, I think, particularly in our market where it's not commonplace. And of course, you know, actually, A-levels, they're given more UCAS points and a lot of our sick form leavers do go to England and their A-levels are, in my view anyway, quite rightly thought of as being a sort of more robust qualification than a higher. So yeah, there's a lot to think about at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't been involved in such detailed analysis of curriculum at a school. However, it's been interesting going round some of the schools and just really realizing how much of this, particularly perhaps lower down the school before you are channeling and funneling into the GCSE A-level IB curricula, which, you know, has been mapped out for you, is how much it's done on a sort of needs basis. I recently went to go and review a school that's a state secondary set where mainly actually due to COVID, they've ended up with a few years of year sevens coming through whose literacy levels are really below average. They do a baseline assessment on all the students who start. And they just saw this really worrying pattern of students whose reading ages were well below where they should be. And therefore, they just simply couldn't access the curriculum that was on offer in senior school, in secondary school. And so rather than sort of ignore it and just sort of try and patch up and move on, they've really grasped the nettle and implemented a huge literacy program in the school. It requires lots of booster sessions using a sort of systematic online program to do it. They have ensured that across the different subjects that they're teaching, that literacy is promoted. So when I was looking at a geography lesson, they were there writing a news article. History, they were doing really good analysis of sources. And around the building were things like posters defining different subject knowledge words and things. And I just thought that is just really impressive. You've seen a problem in a school and you've thought, we need to address this before our students can move on with their learning. And it's really refreshing when you go around and see schools that are taking on a need and really trying to sort it out.
That's so interesting listening to you there, Isabel, because you must see a heck of a lot of schools. So I'd be interested to know how many adapt their curriculum lower down, depending on, you know, what's in front of them in terms of cohorts coming in. But we have a perennial problem where we have several feeder schools. We've now actually partnered with a local prep school, but they by no means will ever provide all of our new entrants. And so we have this perennial problem where we have pupils coming from every type of school from the UK and further afield into our second form or our third form, and it's sort of year eight, year nine in sort of English terms. And they have had completely different educational journeys. And so how do you then deliver a common program? And so that, I mean, I'm not offering the solution here, but what you've just described sounds great. You know, if you've got one particular year group that requires additional input in one area, then having an adaptive curriculum sounds fantastic.
Yeah. It's that word common, isn't it? And I think AI is going to have a massive influence here because, you know, do we have to have a common curriculum? Or do we give pupils greater agency and do we allow them to go at a pace which is suited for them? Because at the moment, you know, 12 months on having joined one school year, everyone then moves on. And we know that some pupils aren't ready to move on. And we know that some pupils should skip a year and go on to the one beyond that. So, but I understand equally there's a lot of social controls needed in school because they're filled with teenagers. And teenagers need to know where the edges of the sandpit are and how to behave. And all that's really important. But I think the traditional interpretation of common and one size fits all or one model fits all and everyone go through the same jelly mold, I think that has to change because that just isn't right. The more that we understand about neurodiversity, for example, shines a light on this one size fits all education model. So actually, I think we will, and I think that's why we're all going to be massively underwhelmed by this National Curriculum Review led by Becky Francis, because it's going to be tiny little turns of the dial, whereas actually we should be much braver. Very easy to say, incredibly difficult to do, because I can talk very enthusiastically just about a school of 850 pupils. It's been incredibly difficult, if only from the teachers, and we have a brilliant set of teachers, but all of their muscle memory, all of their subject understanding, all the familiarity is in the subject silos. And what we're now asking them to do is take a more interdisciplined approach and consciously start assessing skills as well as subject knowledge. And yet a lot of their muscle memory will be GCSEs and A-levels as students, GCSEs and A-levels through their PGCE and training, and the initial stages of their career. So it's really hard, curriculum review, but I just that word common, and I understand it's always had to be that way, but I think AI is going to really stress test that, particularly in a world where our instincts are saying, well, maybe things should be a little bit different for different personalities and learner types.
It's so difficult, isn't it? And that's one thing that I think us presenters were talking about was actually there's also then could become a divide between what's delivered in the state sector versus the independent, because I suppose in the independent sector, you've got the luxury of usually more resources, and that can be kind of physical resources of the fact you've got phenomenal access to laptops, for example, which when I go around to state secondary, that isn't a reality, you know, so you've got physical resource access, but actually also in terms of teacher resource, you've probably got more per pupil, maybe on higher salaries, all that kind of stuff that goes in. And it's it's really, that's what it becomes such a difficult issue, isn't it? It's really wonderful. And as you say, it's been incredibly hard work for you to carve out a really great curriculum for the school in which you work. Yet in terms of your operating base, you've got a phenomenal amount of wealth of resource there. So one can only imagine how difficult that is to shift the dial, as you say, for the entire nation. Where
on that national level, we, at the end, Isabel, of a school pupil's journey, there has to be some sort of tangible metric whereby the government can demonstrate its return on its investment. And that's and that's kind of really kind of crude, sterile terms, but fundamentally, that's what they have to do. So they have, and I'm sure they can, will continue to create a curriculum, a journey with a tangible output. When really, the disconnects between what's possible in the state sector and the independent sector could be reduced if actually we focused on less tangible outcomes like positive mindset, intrinsic motivation, because actually with those in place and the fact that knowledge is now everywhere through the internet, if we can develop intrinsic motivation and the type of skills and character attributes that we were talking about earlier, they can go on and do anything now. You know, so many doors remain open for so much longer. But yet our school curriculum tends to, well, it needs, doesn't it? It needs concrete output that can say, that can demonstrate this cohort of young people have made this much progress. And if that is always going to be the metric, I think it's going to be, I think it's going to really limit curriculum innovation, frankly.
Yes, which, as you say, it's just not adapting to the needs of the world now, particularly with access to information at your fingertips. And as you say, as the introduction of AI. I mean, in fact, actually, Ross and I were just catching up before we started the pod about this conundrum about how much knowledge does a person need to know to be able to operate in the world. Ross, do you want to give your example about the Reformation? I think it's an interesting one.
Yeah, so, I mean, it was just me being slightly silly, but I suppose there's a serious undertone. So I went up to Dunkeld earlier on today just for a walk with my wife and daughter. My daughter's two and a bit, and she asked why Dunkeld Cathedral only had half a roof. And, you know, I thought that was quite an interesting question for a two-year-old. And as a historian, I immediately wanted to say, well, you know, darling, it's because of the Reformation, but that doesn't really carry much currency with a two-year-old. And so I didn't really explain properly why it only has half a roof. And so then it sort of begs the question, unless you opt to study the Reformation, which you wouldn't unless you did A-level history of a particular syllabus, or you went to an independent prep school and studied Common Entrance. And even within that, you would have to select one of the three syllabuses. So it's the Making of the UK, 1485 to 1750. Unless you chose that, which the vast majority of people in the country haven't, you will be looking at every ruined church in the landscape and not knowing why it's ruined, unless, of course, you've taught yourself or some, you know, you've learnt it outside of formal education, i.e. your parents or grandparents have taught you a bit about it, or they've taken you along to an English heritage site or whatever it is. And I think, you know, that in a way, I would consider that part of one's education to be able to understand the world around us and not sort of, I suppose, not look at something which is part of our everyday landscape and either not know it or not know where to begin to fact find, if that makes sense. So anyway, it was just a thought. And, you know, Isabel had quite a good riposte about classrooms in the 1950s, but I'll let her say that.
I was being a bit disparaging. Maybe it was earlier than the 50s where everyone sat in neat little rows having to learn by rote various pieces of information with fearsome teachers looking on. Was that a better way to learn? Insistence that you will learn about the Reformation and also about the rulers of the land. Whereas
what's really exciting about your two-year-old daughter, Ross, is that she was curious. And yes, that's what we want, isn't it? So in a world where information is everywhere and in a multimedia modal mode presented in a multimodal way, she has a curious eye and is brave enough to ask the question. And then kind of goes back, I suppose, my point about intrinsic motivation. Will a curious pupil then actually follow that through? Will they actually pull out their phone because why not? And learn a little bit about the Reformation, or be curious enough to actually step inside and read one of the tourist information plaques. So for me, it's less about the Reformation and it's about actually turning passive curiosity into active curiosity.
Sure.
That's the Holy Grail. And, you know, that's true. I teach chemistry. Was there a pun there when I said Holy Grail? I don't know, but a historian will correct me if there was.
Thank you. Yes, well done for pointing that out to us.
But I'm a chemist, and, you know, I describe GCSE chemistry as anti-chemistry. It's terrible. Because it just doesn't,
oh, I enjoyed it.
It doesn't inculcate the scientific method. It doesn't create curious scientists. What creates curious scientists and kids that want to study it for another 2 years are the stories that we tell around the science. It's the practical demonstrations and it's the practical experiments that they do that excite them. And when they are excited, they will then go to the well and drink for themselves rather than having kind of 1,000 preloaded little cups of drink that we require them to drink, but they don't really know why they're drinking it. I'll stop that metaphor now, but you know what I mean, I think.
I do. And I'm just thinking about all those simultaneous equations I needed to sort out in chemistry GCSE. That's my resounding memory, which I think probably just proves your point, Neil. We talked a little bit about AI and how that is going to meddle with the future of curriculum. Is there anything else looking forward that is likely to be a challenge for the curriculum and how it's designed in the future, do you think? Or is AI the big beast?
Yeah, AI is the new internet, and that in itself is enough to grapple with. I mean, we've got no idea how it's going to change the world, and even on a more micro level, how it's going to change educations. My personal view is that it's going to put a bomb under it, and a really healthy one. But there's almost an entire education piece for parents and teachers and pupils and schools and employers around AI, baseline literacy, but equally applied AI. I can see it. I think the biggest worry about AI is going to be the increasing disparity between the haves and have-nots. And that is going to exacerbate all the other social divides that currently exist. And I think it will happen very, very quickly, personally.
Can you, sorry to sound stupid, but could you elaborate a little bit more on that? How do you think that would happen?
Well, if you're going to, so the evidence is already out there from higher earning income, 70% of people have engaged with ChatGPT. From lower income families, only 30%. So they're starting to play around with this stuff. When they play around with it, pupils, teachers, adults, parents start understanding it, understanding how they can maximize it for productivity or augment what they're doing, or all of the problems with AI, like bias, stereotyping, all that sort of stuff. But I think you mentioned it, Isabel. You see lots of schools, and when you go into, you know, lots of state-maintained schools, brilliant state-maintained schools, they just don't have the infrastructure. They don't have the Wi-Fi, and not everyone, most pupils don't have a one-to-one device. Whereas I work at a school where everyone has a one-to-one device. So the ability to play around with this stuff, access it, learn and understand it is immediate, and therefore the impact will be that much greater. And because of the speed at which these things work, I just think that divide will get big quickly in a really, really unhelpful way.
That's fascinating. Thank you very much for that. I think we're probably working towards the end of our conversation on curriculum for the secondary school. Ross, do you have anything to add?
Just something Neil touched upon earlier on, the communication piece surrounding change and how important that is. And it did make me think about a fairly large change we made at, it was actually a prep school, not a senior school, but it was in the senior years. And we introduced a sustainability curriculum, which I think personally is an area which we're going to see more emphasis of in sort of a wider curriculum sense across the country and hopefully beyond. But In fact, we need it more than ever. Going back to that particular school, we decided to introduce a sustainability course, which was the equivalent of 1 40-minute lesson a week. But of course, as you identified, Isabel, you know, the timetable's so condensed already that 40 minutes had to come from somewhere. And it came from humanities lessons. And the argument was that it was teaching skills as well as practical sustainability. And there was an accredited course to go with it, something called the ISCB IPQ. And we were one of the first schools to uptake that. And it is now one of the most popular courses alongside Common Entrance in prep schools, you know, around the world. It is brilliant for sort of contemporary knowledge acquisition and just learning about the world, but then applying it in a really exciting way of the people's own choosing. And it is celebrated in the form of a Viva at the end. And it's just something which, well, personally, I didn't experience until I was at university, this idea of like standing up and presenting about something that you're particularly passionate about. And, you know, it was just a wonderful thing. So we introduced that. We actually didn't communicate the change until after we'd won our first award for the course. And then sort of a stack of awards started coming in where we were being recognized by, you know, well, actually people much like yourselves writing for your magazine. And, you know, they're nice to have. Every school wants a gong, I suppose, to recognize a change like that. But we just saw it in terms of the value we were adding to the pupils. And it was a great, great thing. And I've recommended it to several schools since. So I think the communication piece is important. If you firmly believe that you're making change for the right reasons and you've researched it and you've looked into it, I don't think we need to be scared of changing the curriculum. And I think if a precedent's already there and it's been done by another school, then that's obviously a lot easier. But particularly in Neil's world and my world, where, you know, parents tend to be fee payers, you do need to have some justification around, you know, changing the curriculum. And sometimes pedagogy and metacognition might not carry that value with the parent that we would hope it would.
Thanks, Ross. Well, Neil, we like to finish every podcast with the same question to us all, which is, what is exciting you in education right now?
AI, without doubt. I think the more we learn about how pupils can use it to support them outside of the classroom as we make a move towards precision education, so they are getting what they need for them rather than what is planned for a class of 20. The immediacy of response that it can give, the way that it can be trained to interact with you in a way that suits you and your personality type, I think that's really interesting. And as someone who helps run a school, all of the productivity gains that can come from it. I don't believe it's going to make, you know, millions of people redundant, but I think it's going to change the nature of work and we will see a different type of work. But I think there's going to be a period of time where, before we get to that, the panacea, AI is going to be very expensive. So there's a period of time when we have to invest in it. And it's going to be really expensive before we get to the critical mass where we stop asking a member of staff to do that, but actually to do this. It's coming, and it's coming fast, albeit a lot of the rhetoric is being driven by big corporate who are responsible to their stakeholders. And actually, we're schools and we're really complex beasts and we move at a much slower pace. We move with the best interest of the pupils at the core of our thinking. I think we're much more judicious and rightly cautious. But I think all schools have an obligation to start gathering some momentum in this. Kind of ignore the big noise out there, because as I say, I firmly believe that's for the corporate world. But, you know, we're a school, as I said right at the beginning of the pod, you know, an education for life. Well, AI is going to be part of people's lives in 2028, 2029, 2030 and beyond. So I think so. It's going to get really interesting really quickly.
Thanks, Neil. Anything from you, Ross?
No, I've just been sort of listening, and I agree with everything Neil's been saying. I think it's a very exciting time in many respects, and I think, you know, we've spoken on the pod before about some of the benefits of AI. I think you know, probably Neil has seen some of the drawbacks in terms of pupil misuse of AI. And, mm-hmm. and so, you know, I can certainly say that I have. And so I think that there's definitely some work to be done about how we utilize it for you know, for good in schools. But in terms of workload and tailoring education to individual pupils' needs, I think, you know, my goodness, it's certainly going to change that landscape. We looked at report writing, you know, the bane of every teacher's life. You get to the end of term and you've suddenly got to communicate everything you know about a pupil in your subject and, you know, concise and a time efficient way whilst also doing the rest of your job. There are lots of tools out there being developed, and you know, we've interviewed one of the founders of one of those pieces before. That's just one of many examples, I think, of how it could be used for good. But yeah, I think, yeah, as Neil says, it's going to be a very, very interesting time. I think what you're saying, Neil, about the earlier on about moving away from GCSEs, I'd love to almost jump in a time machine and come and visit Bradfield in a couple of years' time and see when the balance has maybe tipped so that the majority of those GCSEs or those subjects are no longer sitting GCSEs, and just see whether you guys have seen some benefit to your A-level or your IB program, for instance, or even just in anecdotally and how the pupils present themselves and what you're writing on personal statements. I think that would be really interesting. So maybe it's one to sort of pigeonhole for the future and have a follow-up on.
Well, you'd be very welcome to visit, but you're absolutely right. You know, the key thing in all of this, and it's, you know, I'm anticipating our governing body asking exactly this question, is, you know, what is the impact been? How are you going to decide whether or not it's been a success? What are the KPIs for these GCSE alternatives, these level two alternatives?
Well, yes, as you say, you're still held hostage by exactly as many schools are in terms of what we're talking about with governments, isn't it, on actually having proof data that can justify your decisions. Well, we shall leave you with that conundrum, Neil. And I think it's probably time to say thank you very much. Thank you, Neil, so much for being part of our podcast. I feel like we've had a really valuable discussion about senior school curriculum and just what that can look like in a variety of different settings. So thanks for joining us. And we'll see you soon. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Rest is Education. If you would like to follow us, please do. We are on Instagram, we're on LinkedIn, and you can also email us at therestiseducation@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.